From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Golhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The United States is experiencing record levels of wealth inequality, with money flowing to the top into ever fewer hands, and those with obscene wealth using it to influence government policies to benefit them. With a new tax reform law quite literally defunding the U.S. Treasury, Republicans are attempting to use the debt to justify cuts to the modest remnants of our social safety net program. More and more Americans are turning to private forms of aid, including loans, investments, and gifts to boost funding for things like public education, healthcare, homelessness, disability, and so many other critical social needs. We are supposed to be grateful to the philanthropists that generously fund these ventures and good causes. But what if the philanthropic world is part of the problem? After all, to give money, you have to have money. And if you have money, you are part of the wealthy elite class that has contributed to inequality in the first place. It is this conundrum that my guest writes about in his new book, Decolonizing Wealth, Indigenous Wisdom to Heal Divides and Restore Balance. In it, author Edgar Villanueva points out that the world of philanthropy mirrors colonial structures and destructive hierarchies may be doing more harm than good. Edgar Villanueva is Vice President of Programs and Advocacy at the Schott Foundation for Public Education. He's also the Chair of the Board of Directors of Native Americans in Philanthropy and a board member of an Andrus Family Fund. He is a member of the Lumbee Tribe of North Carolina. Welcome to the program, Edgar.
Thank you for having me on.
So it's interesting that you, as somebody in the world of philanthropy, has written such a powerful and scathing critique of the world of philanthropy. One would expect an outsider to deliver this kind of critique. What led you to, what's the journey that led you to see the world of philanthropy as unfortunately reproducing the very structures of hierarchy and colonialism that many of us hope and think that it is trying to dismantle?
Yeah, so, you know, there's a lot of folks in the general public who are not even aware that this philanthropic infrastructure, the foundation industry, so to speak, exists in this country. Folks are not aware that there are $800 billion in assets that foundations are sitting on. And so often, because it's an insular industry, you have to be on the inside to really know what's going on. Because when you hear the word philanthropy and you see what foundations are doing across the country, there is sort of the veneer of charity that seems like a good thing. Philanthropy is a word that literally means, you know, love of humankind. And so on the surface, you would never suspect that what's actually happening in the space of philanthropy and social impact and investing and so on, that there might be things that are happening that are actually further destabilizing our communities.
So especially those people who've ever been through the process of trying to acquire money from grant-making organizations or the microloan industry, et cetera, have seen firsthand the problems with it. I mean, my own experience I found when, say, trying to get grants for the show that I do, is that if you're not already hooked into the sort of community, the relatively invisible community of largely white funders and their social circle, it's very difficult to convince them to give you money. And they end up funding their friends and their friends' friends. And you wonder what it is that you're doing wrong, not to mention the enormous amounts of time, effort, and energy and training that's required to even jump through all the hoops that are required to get the money, only to be told no at the very last step. Is the system sort of set up to leave out those people who need money for their projects the most?
You're absolutely right. As you said in your intro remarks, folks who have wealth, if you have the privilege to actually start a foundation, you're most likely a wealthy white person. And if you think about the proximity that those folks have to problems on the ground, the proximity relationships that they probably do not have with people of color, all of those are direct correlations to where money is going. They are, in fact, funding their friends. They are funding folks within their network. They're funding issues mostly that are more connected to their personal lives, Ivy League institutions, museums, that type of thing. When you look at where funding is going and with foundations, for example, I mentioned the $800 billion in foundation assets. Only 5% of those funds are actually being granted out into the community. And so only a small fraction of money is actually leaving the doors of foundations. And then when you begin to analyze, especially by race, where those dollars are going, only about 7 to 8% of grant-making dollars are actually being invested in communities of color. And so nonprofits that are led by people of color, nonprofits that are working in communities of color are getting very just crumbs of the grant-making dollars.
I was struck, Edgar, by this really interesting section in your book, which, by the way, is immensely readable. In a section of your book, Decolonizing Wealth, you have a section called What Seeking Funds Feels Like, where you basically try to put people in the position of a patient seeking help from a doctor. Can you give us that metaphor on our interview?
Absolutely. It's if you've ever been a fundraiser or on the side of a nonprofit seeking funds, it's very frustrating, as you said earlier. Often you understand what the problem is. In communities that are closest to problems, we often know what the best solutions are. Yet we are in the position of going around and seeking help from those who have more power. And more resources, and so to speak, sometimes more expertise, at least in their minds, around what the problems really are. And so we are caught between this balance of trying to resolve problems on our own in our own communities, but yet relying on the resources of those who are far from the problems, because they have the power and the resources that we actually need. In our communities to implement the solutions that we know work.
So, do you think that those people who are involved in these grant-making organizations are aware of how they're coming across to the people that need it most? For example, are they looking at the statistics of who they grant money to and realizing with horror that such a tiny percent of it is going to communities of color? You said something like 7 or 8% of all the money that's granted. Are they reflecting on the fact that this money is basically still going into the hands of largely privileged folks?
I do think that there's more awareness. I've been working in philanthropy now for 14 years, and the conversations that we're having now, and especially around this book, are conversations that I never imagined, even 5 years ago, that we would be having. And so there is, within the field, I think more awareness, more accountability. It's really a best practice to track your grant making and to understand the impact and who is benefiting from your grant making. Now I say that with the hopes that we'll actually see the dollars begin to trickle out into communities that need the resources the most, but we're not seeing that change just yet. We're very guilty in philanthropy of overanalyzing problems. There's been so many conferences that I've attended that have the theme of equity. And I think that grant makers and folks with privilege and wealth are still grappling with actually how to do that, how to give up their power, and how to move resources in a way that is going to fundamentally transform how we do business. That is really hard work, and I think that I'm still hoping and I'm pushing for grant makers and folks that I'm talking to be willing to do that work so that we can actually practice what we are talking about and see that come to pass.
So even when one does get a grant that one has worked incredibly hard to actually get, the conditions to that the grant makers impose are very high, very specific, require an incredibly quick turnaround. I'll give you an example of my own personal example, my own experience in talking to a grant maker about funding a program. program like mine, the question that I kept getting asked was, what are the measurable outcomes? Well, I have no idea. How do people consume media and then go out and act upon it? That's not something that's easy to measure. One puts information out there and hopes that it does the right thing. But the mere fact of a person of color addressing issues of inequality and social justice was not enough for the grant makers. And so how does that, is that a common theme that those people who are grantees find that the conditions put upon the money are so high that it reproduces this inequality that exists in the first place?
Absolutely. I think that evaluation and all of these criteria within foundations, how we're evaluating who we fund, once we fund someone, how we're evaluating the impact of those grants, all of those processes can be tools of white supremacy and really perpetuate inequality, even with the best intentions. I think, I describe what I call colonizing dynamics. And, colonizing dynamics are basically perpetuating dynamics of white supremacy. And we have a history of colonization in this country and the way that wealth has been accumulated and the policies and practices in our current day that we see still kind of creating that separation of the haves and the have-nots and who has resources and who does not have resources. And so all of these practices within philanthropy need to be examined. I think that, we often think of investing in a person of color or a community of color as risk capital. And the fact that that is considered to be a risky investment, I think is just ridiculous. When we are working in institutions that have missions and sometimes missions of social justice, and we are required by law to invest resources and not necessarily are looking for the same type of returns on financial returns on grants. And so all of these types of barriers have been put in place, maybe intentionally, maybe unintentionally, that are perpetuating this disparity of not investing in people of color and communities of color that need to be addressed.
I'm imagining that there's a pretty large savior complex in some parts of the world of philanthropy. Do you have any examples you can give us without naming names, or feel free to name names?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that this entire sector, in a sense, is just wrought with the white savior complex, I will say. I think there is an element of white dominant culture or white supremacy that feels like, white is better. The white way, is the right way.
I'm assuming they don't say it out loud, but the actions speak louder than the words.
Yeah, it shows up. It does show up in ways that are subtle, right? And yeah. If we are not held accountable as a sector in philanthropy because we hold power, we hold money, it's just very easy for folks to behave in ways that you think you're being helpful. But all the time this happens where folks with power, money, and privilege descend into communities, wanting to help because it feels good to help and we have the resources. But if we are not centering people of color, if we're not centering indigenous leadership or native leadership in communities, and at the end of the day, if we're not sort of funding and getting out of the way of progress, then we have to ask ourselves, are we perpetuating these colonial dynamics or being white saviors?
I want to focus on the very important, most important part of your book, which is how indigenous wisdom can be used to right the wrongs in philanthropy. Sounds like you are deeply involved in the world of Native American philanthropy. What is it that we can learn from indigenous cultures and traditions that can help us rewrite the script on the interactions between those who have wealth and want to use it for good and those who need it?
In writing this book, I had the opportunity to take a journey back into my own soul and my being, and understanding and reconnecting to my culture. And I gleaned a lot of personal growth and experience from that. because as a Native American person working in this space, there's a lot of forced assimilation. And in order to progress and to make a difference, I felt that I had to give a part of that up. And so in sort of reclaiming that identity and that culture, I was really just struck by the opportunity of sharing this wisdom, because I think it is the best path forward. So in my community, we're very focused on healing. Obviously, we have a lot of trauma from generations of colonization and genocide. And so as a part of that healing process, we are it's very focused on reciprocity and relationship building, being connected to others, including the oppressor. And so I think when we think about institutional philanthropy and grant making, it's very transactional. It's very much around, you know, one dimensional. It's not relationship based. It's
and the power lies in the money, right? That person who has the money has the power to give it and can wield power using that money and can rewrite the solutions that are required, whether or not those are the right solutions.
Absolutely. And so, you know, the idea of doing using money and wealth as bringing an indigenous perspective to that is sort of flipping that and thinking about the allocation of resources in a way that is more equitable, that is about sharing power, that is relationship based, that is giving, because we know that in giving, we are also going to receive back, you know, education and relationships and knowledge from the community. And so that requires being accountable to the community and being, you know, having close proximity and building the relationships, you know, around those power dynamics that funders just often are not well equipped to do, because they have not dealt with their own privilege and whiteness and, you know, proximity to wealth. So this book invites folks to go on that personal healing journey so that they would be, you know, more in a better position to build those types of relationships with community.
What advice then would you give to those grant makers who really are sincerely interested in their money because they might have been lucky in life or whatever, doing real good? What advice can you, because there are, you know, I can see from a perspective of a grant maker that there is a fear that the money gets misused or wasted or, you know, gets sucked up into too much overhead expenses. And a lot of those requirements, those conditions put on grant money come from or seem to come from those concerns. So what advice would you give to a grant maker who really wants their money to do good?
You know, I think I feel that most grant makers want that. I don't think that anyone gets up every day and goes to work in a foundation and says, you know, I want to see how I can be racist today with my grant making. And so what I'm asking folks to do, there's stories in the book around folks who, white folks, people with wealth, who have actually gone through the process of coming to terms with that wealth and coming to terms with that privilege. Peter Buffett wrote and Jennifer Buffett wrote the foreword to my book, and they are examples of folks who have done that personal work that is required if you're going to be a grant maker who funds with a true lens of equity.
When you are also looking at those groups that desperately need the funds to do good in their communities, are there ways, or do you advise them to not go out and get involved in the grant making process? Because sometimes even entering the world of philanthropy can make those, you know, organizations, the nonprofit groups, subtly, subconsciously change their mandate. It in a way can sully the work that they're doing when they go out looking for grants. Do you ever advise them to find a different way?
You know, in my heart, I want to, you know, there's a book called The Revolution Will Not Be Funded, right?
Yes, I've seen it. It was about a decade ago, I believe.
You know, I dream of a world where philanthropy does not exist, where it's like Wakanda and we are all resilient. But, you know, I think that all of us coming from the community, nonprofits, we need resources, and the resources that sit in foundations are our resources. We need to reclaim that money. This is money that was made on the backs of people of color, from stolen land, from slavery, genocide, exploiting people.
That is a really important point. I think that let's expand on that. The wealth of the philanthropic world is wealth that is relative. They are rich because we are poor, and they have, many of them have made their money directly or indirectly through institutions that have oppressed the very people that are supposed to be now asking them for some of that money back.
Absolutely. And so that is sort of the craziness of all of this is that, you know, I say the money was actually twice stolen because it was made on the backs of people of color. And then it's also money that is now sheltered from taxation. So the money that is sitting in the foundation not being made in grants, because remember, only 5% is going out in grants, is sitting there generating more wealth because of the investments. And this is money that could be going into public education and healthcare and elder care and taking care of our communities. And so one, we need to, that's something that should be examined as the tax system in this country that allows people to get that wealthy, that allows folks to not pay taxes and set up foundations and then sit on that money and not even invest the money in communities. So there's a lot of problematic stuff there. So for my nonprofit partners and friends, I think that we have no choice but to engage in the system because money is something that is needed. It's money, it's money that our families and our ancestors have been a part of helping to accumulate. And so what I say is that we have to just be aware of what our history and orientation is to money and find funders, because there are good funders out there. Find partners who are not going to impose on your work, because ultimately as a nonprofit, you have to remain accountable to your community and to your board and to your mission more so than, a funder.
Is there room for affirmative action of a sort in the philanthropic world? These are private organizations, most of them, all of them. And so they don't have to be bound by the rules that, say, public universities have to be bound by. Can they not impose on themselves a sort of affirmative action to very, systematically right the wrongs, especially when it comes to race or gender or other, forms of isms in our society?
I think that's a really great idea. Philanthropy has often wanted to be, we have very little accountability. And so we've often been in the position of wanting to self-correct. And I think I've seen some progress, as we talked about earlier. However, I don't trust that we're going to get there fast enough. I don't think we're going to self-correct. And so I think I'm very open to the idea of legislation that would push and require foundations to invest their money, to increase the amount of money going out the door, to look at the governance of foundations and requiring some type of governance or board structures that reflect the community, and to look at these resources and allocate in ways that are reflective of our demographics and the history of this country. In some places like Canada, there is a process that's happening with a lot of community foundations where they are looking at the truth and reconciliation process that the government has led and are beginning to explore internally with their giving. Are we grant making and giving in a way that is remembering that history of genocide and on Native Americans, for example? And so I think those are ideas that we need to explore and to create some public demand for.
Why are foundations not giving away more of their money? Why are they sitting on the vast majority of it? I mean, we know, of course, that when you alluded to this earlier, wealthy people and institutions can get around taxation by or reduce their taxes by putting their money into grant-making foundations. The sort of nonprofit rules that we have with the IRS enable them to get benefits by diverting some of their wealth into philanthropy. But are they also making money by just sitting on it?
It's really good questions that you're raising. I think that, these types of questions make me wonder about the net value of philanthropy, right? Because the 5% payout rule that was put in place by Congress was intended actually to be a minimum. That 5% has become the maximum. And so it's really sad that that Congress had to enact a law to kind of force foundations to pay out something. And so that speaks to what's really happening in this space, that the focus and priority is actually on accumulating more wealth, building out the legacy of a family. And folks kind of hide behind the idea of, well, we need to invest this money, and this money needs to grow so that we will have more money to make in grants, right? Which I think is a really delusional type of statement. The other thing that is important for folks to understand, with the 95% of funds that are not being paid out in grants, right? These funds are being invested in order to grow the endowment, and they're being invested in ways that are very, values neutral. In most cases, and more than 80 to 85% of foundations are actually invested in at very extractive types of funds. And so funds that are harming the land, funds that are harming people, and that are probably canceling out the good that they might be doing with their 5%. And so that is another area where there's, most people don't know that on the investment side of foundations, those folks are getting paid the most. And we, in general, don't know where a lot of folks are investing. It's not public. But the data and research that has been done around the investment side of foundations, they're actually investing mostly in harmful and extractive industries.
So finally, Edgar, I'm hoping that your book gets into the hands of grant makers and helps them understand, especially from the perspective of communities of color, what the world looks like from the outside and how it doesn't benefit enough people in a good enough way. Is there a website you can recommend and next steps for, people who might hear this interview and want to get the book into other people's hands? I'm assuming you're on book tour as well.
Yeah, I am on a book tour. I'm speaking at a lot of philanthropy conferences. I'm also speaking with banks, governments. These principles apply to everyone, regardless of whether you're a nonprofit, all of the institutions that move and control money, and even individuals who are looking at their own giving and their history and orientation to funding. So learn more at decolonizingwealth.com. You can order the book there. We have some Decolonizer t-shirts. All of the proceeds from the sale of the book will benefit Native youth. So I'm trying to influence the conversation, but also use this opportunity to actually raise money to support my community.
Wonderful. I really appreciate your time. Thanks so much, Edgar, and good luck to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
My guest has been Edgar Villanueva, Vice President of Programs and Advocacy at the Schott Foundation for Public Education. He is also the chair of the Board of Directors of Native Americans in Philanthropy. He's a member of the Lumbee Tribe of North Carolina. We've been discussing his new book, Decolonizing Wealth: Indigenous Wisdom to Heal Divides and Restore Balance. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and now on Instagram at RU with Sonali.